Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. To the great relief of many, the year 2020 is just about over, and the coronavirus is still spreading through the country. But the arrival of several vaccines have become what some see as the light at the end of the tunnel. Today on The Exchange, we look back at the year, and we remember some of the notable Siouxland residents we lost to COVID-19. Also, we remember the death of George Floyd and the many marches and protests that took place this summer. But first, a look way back to the beginning of 2020. I thought to myself in late January that the Iowa caucuses, the primary, and the general election would be my main focus for the year. Well, it didn't turn out quite like that. But before the shutdown caused by COVID-19, Democratic politicians swarmed the state and Siouxland for Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses. The caucus results created a controversy on the Democratic side because of delays in reporting. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg won first place, followed by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and President-elect Joe Biden came in fourth. In the months leading up to the caucuses on February 3rd, the candidates sought out the support of Siouxland residents. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer covered most of the candidates. She covered Bernie Sanders when he came to the Sioux City Convention Center just before the election. Here's that report.
The band Portugal the Man entertains a group of more than 1,100. A rock concert atmosphere full of energized supporters for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in Sioux City. Some couldn't even fit in the room.
He's the Trump stopper, and his name is Bernie Sanders.
Movie director Michael Moore told the crowd he's tired of Democrats playing it safe.
What has it gotten us? No increase in people's wages in 30-plus years?
Then Moore introduced another one of Bernie's big Democratic supporters.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez!
The New York congresswoman, also known as AOC.
You know, this is our moment. This is our shot. And so what we need to do is make sure that we actually translate this energy into the caucus.
And why I believe we're going to win is that we have put together in this state the most extraordinary grassroots movement that I think Iowa has ever seen.
Sanders returned to D.C. on Sunday night to serve as a juror in the impeachment trial of President Trump. He originally planned on visiting every part of the state every day before the Iowa caucuses with a message of working class people fighting for change.
And with your help, we have an excellent chance to win here in Iowa.
And Bernie says his momentum to the White House starts a week from Monday night.
And if we win in New Hampshire, we're going to win in Nevada. And if we win in Nevada, we're going to do damn well in South Carolina. We're going to win in California.
In Sioux City, for Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Former Vice President Joe Biden was at Western Iowa Tech Community College. Biden greeted the crowd with a few jokes and then began to talk about the need to return to what he called decency in American life. Biden told the crowd he doesn't believe that the United States is the dark, angry nation that President Donald Trump tweets about late at night.
I don't believe we're a nation that puts kids in cages. I don't believe we're a nation that builds walls and whips up hysteria about invasions of immigrants. I don't believe we're a nation that embraces white supremacists and hate groups. I don't believe we're a nation that bows down to Vladimir Putin, and I sure in heck am not going to. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't believe we're a nation that sees the free press as the enemy of the people. I don't believe we're a nation. I don't believe we're a nation that says fulfilling your oath of office is optional. Where does it say optional? Folks, when I look at Donald Trump, what he stands for, how he behaves, what he's done, we're better than this. That's what I think of. We're just better. My same response is the same. America is so much better than this.
Biden said he would make climate change action a priority and make sure that economic success included work and not just wealth. Biden ended his appearance by saying, Everyone knows who Donald Trump is, and it was time to let people know who he and many of the American people are today.
We choose hope over fear. We choose science over fiction. We choose unity over division. And yes, we choose truth over lies. Folks, this is the United States of America. We're all walking around with our heads down, like, woe are us. What's the matter? It's time to get up. We've never failed to meet an objective when we've done it together. Never has America failed. So remember, the future is incredibly bright. We get this guy out of the way, there's not a thing we cannot do. Thank you.
And again, that last candidate was, of course, President-elect Joe Biden at Western Iowa Tech Community College not long before the caucuses. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer covered many campaign events, and she also found insight from a young but informed source with aspirations of her own.
Disco lights and an occasional Disney tune set the scene for roller skating night at Girls Inc. in Sioux City, a gymnasium full of young ladies and one a bit beyond her years.
I'm Maggie. I'm 10.
A tenacious and at times typical fifth grader.
I like to play soccer, sing, play guitar, and do art. I want to be the president when I grow up.
All she knows as a six-year-old is Trump says he's going to build a wall between us and Mexico, and some of her friends are Mexican.
Maggie's mother, Tracy Taylor, says her daughter's political aspirations started when Donald Trump became president.
It made me be like, oh my gosh, this is a very important thing, and I need to step into it and, like, do it.
2 years ago, Girls Inc. sent Maggie and Tracy to take our daughters to Congress Day in Washington, D.C.
That, like, fueled my fire.
Today, Maggie doesn't have to go far to see the political system in action, with Iowa holding the first in the nation caucuses.
What are the most important issues for you when it comes to a candidate?
Gun control, immigration, women's rights, and climate change.
Maggie's met about a dozen of the Democratic contenders from the top tier, including Senator Bernie Sanders and Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
We also have to face these huge issues.
It was on the worst snow day that we had.
To a few who dropped out of the race.
Who do you think's been the nicest so far?
Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke.
Maggie favored both men and now puts Andrew Yang at the top of her list.
Gave me a really, really cool high five.
Others also pique her interest.
You also had a chance to meet Tulsi Gabbard?
She was, like, probably one of my first favorites, and she still is.
So did you get to see Amy Klobuchar when she was here?
Yes, I did. She wasn't as outgoing as the other candidates, but I still really liked her.
Not all of the women in the race appeal to this pint-sized pundit.
You don't want to see Elizabeth Warren? No. Okay.
When it comes to the pursuit of politics, Maggie shares the secret of securing a little of the spotlight.
My mom told me that if you go to the front of the line is either the best or the back of the line is the best, so you can have as much time as you want.
However, being the youngest person in the room doesn't hurt either.
So, do you have brothers and sisters? What's the name of your school?
Irving.
A couple of weeks ago at a local diner, John Delaney spent several minutes getting to know Maggie and her parents while sharing his ideas for the country.
I believe women and men should have equal rights.
I am learning right along with her, and I hate to say that. That sounds really un-American and not very responsible, but I definitely don't have all the answers, and she challenges me and involves me more than I would be if she weren't interested, for sure.
Maggie's persistence also put her in the middle of a peaceful protest when former Secretary of State John Kerry campaigned for Joe Biden. An acquaintance on her father's side.
My grandpa died. He sent flowers. One reason he is super good, well, a good candidate, is because he has been in the office already about 4 years ago. 4 years ago with Obama.
Why do you want to be president someday, Maggie?
We don't want there to be other presidents, in my opinion, that are like this one, who just don't do what a president is made to be doing. I want to make sure in 2048 that doesn't happen.
Skeptics might think Tracy Taylor influences her daughter's decisions and thoughts, but she says that's far from the truth.
We try to give her both sides of the argument, but she's a smart kid. We don't talk really about politics at our house, which sounds crazy for someone who wants to be president, but my family is very much Republicans and my husband's family is very much Democrats. And so it's not something we talk about at the dinner table very often. A lot of adults question what my husband and I do with her politically. But because she comes from it from that idealistic place, it's important for me to let her keep doing it because maybe she can change the world.
But your family actually does have presidential ties anyway.
Yeah. I think it's my husband's like, I don't know
great,
how many greats. Several great uncles was Zachary Taylor.
And the funny story is that he died of like spoiled milk. From spoiled milk. And I say this now, maybe that's why I'm lactose intolerant.
Generations later, another Taylor aspires to be in the White House as she sizes up the options for this year between homework, hobbies, and hanging out with friends. He has this advice for the adults.
This is the most important election, so you should probably go out and vote.
And maybe someday you'll see the name of Maggie Taylor on the ballot. For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
After the caucuses, Maggie was selected to join the Mayor's Youth Commission's Young Ambassador Program. She also serves on her student council at East Middle School. She was extremely happy to get birthday videos from Senator Cory Booker and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, and a very nice letter from President-elect Joe Biden. She still plans to run for president in 2048. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. One of the other important stories of this year in Siouxland was the passage of a $50 million jail referendum. In a special referendum in March, 57% of voters supported the building of a new jail. It only required 50% to pass. The day after the passage of the referendum, I talked to Keith Radig, who sits on the Board of Supervisors, about his hopes for the new jail. He says it will ease crowding and make it safer for those incarcerated to go to court.
You know, I didn't think the existing jail is going to make it too much longer. And so it's good to see that, the voters approve of the project and the plan moving forward. And so we got to take those next steps and get design going and get it bid out and then get it built. That's going to take close to 9 months to start construction because it's going to have to be designed. Then you'll have to get, the time frames to get it all bid out. And that'll take about 3 months on that part of the getting it bid out, 6 months on the design side.
So do you think this will take at least a year and a half to get it built?
A year and 9 months to 2 years, probably. So say your prayers that the existing building makes it that long.
Did you think that this was going to happen? Because I really felt like when we had the forum and people were asking questions, I really didn't hear a lot of people who were very against it.
When I started out the process of going out into the public forums and meetings, we'd get into a room and everybody was against it from the beginning. But by the end of the meeting, almost everybody was for it. So I really felt like as long as we got the information out there, people would support it.
I learned a lot having the forum myself because it's really hard to know all the ins and outs of something like this, even if you think you do.
Right. Well, and, most people don't realize that this has been something that's been looked at by the county for over a decade. So they've tried every single alternative program. And then, of course, moving forward, having, the felony division out there, it'll make, make for a lot less transport on the inmate side. They're just going to walk down a hall, basically, so it's going to be a lot more efficient in operations as well.
Are there any other big projects on the horizon? I'm sure there are other big projects, but.
Oh, for the county? I mean, just, the jail at this point is the largest. Another thing that we do have to start planning for on the horizon would be, more maintenance projects of the courthouse itself. It's a 101-year-old building now, and it took a lot of deferred maintenance over 40 years. And so, now you got to catch up on some of those projects. I just would like to say thank you to all the voters for getting out and voting. And I would like to thank them for, passing it so we can move forward and build the new jail and total law enforcement center package and get this thing built.
That was Woodbury County Supervisor Keith Radig talking about the passage of the jail referendum earlier this year. The board approved the schematic for the new $50 million jail on October 27th. It will be built on a 38-acre plot of land in the vicinity of the Lake Forest mobile home community. And Radig won another term on the board in the November 3rd election. That election, as well as the primaries, was dominated by early and absentee voting as people were concerned about exposure to COVID-19. Yet there was heavy voter turnout in both elections. The only Democrat on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors ends his term this week. The head of security at Briarcliff University, Marty Potterbaum, had served one term on the Board of Supervisors. Former Supervisor Jeremy Taylor will be sworn in. Taylor resigned his prior Supervisor District 2 seat on January 31st after a controversy over which of two homes in different districts constituted his legal residence. The county's chief election official, Pat Gill, said he would cancel Taylor's voter registration over questions about his official address. I spoke with Taylor about his win the day after the November 3rd election.
It's something that I poured myself into in terms of the last several years, and so I'm just really appreciative of being able to continue working and hopefully working hard at that.
You defeated the only Democrat. Were you at all concerned after resigning from the board earlier this year because of the residency issue that might dog your campaign?
Well, it certainly was the main issue and a negative one at that for my opponent. But ultimately, I'm just appreciative that voters looked at our records. That's what I ran on in terms of having 20 or more tangible accomplishments and asking for voters to take a step back and look at what we've done on the board and what we're promising to do going forward. And so in about a 3-month period of time, it was appreciated by me that voters ultimately looked at who would best represent them and our records in the past.
That was Jeremy Taylor. He was reelected to the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors in the November election after resigning his District 2 seat because of residency issues. That seat was won in a special election by Republican Sioux City teacher Justin Wright, who triumphed over outgoing Sioux City House Representative Tim Cassina. That election was delayed from earlier this year because of COVID-19. And in June, Taylor was an unsuccessful candidate, coming in third place in the Republican primary in Iowa's 4th congressional district race. State Senator Randy Feenstra won that 4th district primary in June. Feenstra displaced 18-year veteran Representative Steve King. Feenstra won by more than 10 percentage points. In the November election, Feenstra handily won his race against Sioux City Democrat J.D. Shulton. Here is what Feenstra had to say on election night.
Tonight, we deliver a victory for the people of Iowa in the 4th district. And nearly 2 years ago, 22 months ago, I launched my campaign for Congress because I believed Iowa in the 4th district needed a seat at the table. They needed somebody with a proven, effective, conservative voice that could get things done and create results for the people of the 4th district in Congress. This campaign has been hard fought. I want to thank J.D. Shulton for the energy he brought to this race.
And here's Sioux City's J.D. Shulton conceding that race.
Hey, everybody. We decided that we are conceding, and we lost. I am bummed, to say the least, but, you know, we worked our tails off. We outworked them, we outraised them, we outorganized, we out everything, but we ended up not getting the results we wanted. And, you know, I think a lot about my baseball days and think about when you prepare yourself and you do everything right, sometimes things are just outside of your ability. And so it's just one of those things. And so I absolutely have to thank everybody for all the supporters, everyone who's volunteered and gave them their time, their resources. I'm just so appreciative, so grateful to have so many people have our backs this entire time. You know, I think about where I was several years ago before I decided to run, and you know, I I used to make a joke saying that I don't know if this is the smartest or dumbest thing I ever done, but you know, just all the relationships we built along the way, I have a lot of great memories, and I'm just very, very, very grateful.
That was Sioux City Democratic 4th District candidate J.D. Shulton conceding the race to winner Randy Feenstra in November. Also this fall, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst held on to her seat, remaining the junior senator from Iowa. She was challenged by Des Moines Democrat Teresa Greenfield. Here's what Ernst had to say after winning on election night.
For those of you that voted for me, I want to thank you. And just as I have for the last 6 years, I will spend the next 6 years working every single day to live up to the honor that you have given me as your United States Senator. But I'd also like to say something to every Iowan, whether you supported me or not. This has been a very difficult year and a very challenging election for all of us. People on both sides feel divided. Emotions and those wounds are very, very raw. But the election is over, and it's time to start the healing. We need to turn down the rhetoric and start listening once again. Yeah, thank you.
And Teresa Greenfield thanked her supporters that night, her voice choked with emotion.
I want to thank all the Iowans who volunteered, who text, who phone bank, folks that chipped in a few bucks. You really are what made this campaign a strong grassroots campaign, so thank you for that. I want to thank my staff. Let's hear from you again. You are incredible, you really are, and I hope you are all proud of what we accomplished. I know I certainly am. I want to thank my brothers and sisters in organized labor. You all built the middle class, and you were there for me when I needed it most. You've always had my back, and I always have yours. I want to thank my husband, Steve. He's been putting up with me for over 28 years. Our children, the whole family, especially my dear twin sister, Maria. She has been my super volunteer.
That was Democratic Senate candidate Teresa Greenfield conceding the Senate race against the incumbent Republican Joni Ernst on the evening of November 3rd, the general election this fall. You're listening to The Exchange. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative for Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City. Serving the financial planning needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, I'm Mary Hartnett. Juneteenth, celebrated on June 19th, commemorates the day the slaves in the United States were freed. This summer, Juneteenth took on a special focus as protesters across the country marched in reaction to the death of George Floyd. Floyd was killed at the hands of Minneapolis police on Memorial Day weekend, sparking outrage that has not been seen since the marches and protests of the 1960s. In early July, we talked about what Juneteenth meant in the days following the death of George Floyd with the president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP, Ike Rayford. We also talked about the legislature's action this year to pass a bill to stop help police brutality in Iowa.
You know, I think there's always more to be done. When you think of where we are today and where we're trying to get to, you know, there is nothing, and there's never going to be, you know, that moment where you can say, okay, it's all done. You know, I think LBJ said it best, you know, when you are trying to run a, you know, 100-yard race and you give the, you know, the person, you know, your oppressor or however you want to describe it, if you give them, you know, 50 yards, then and now you're saying, okay, let's run this race. Well, you know, we still have to make up that ground. And, you know, if everybody's moving, then, you know, those things and those issues that we've been faced is still 50, you know, yards ahead of us. So it's impossible to catch up at that point. So I think things that, you know, I am happy that and thrilled that some things are taking place. And especially, you know, in light of all the things that have happened. But yeah, we still got a long ways to go because there's a lot. I mean, this systemic racism and systemic hate is deep. It's deep, you know. And like they say, when you're gardening, you got to pull this thing up by the root so that it doesn't continue to grow and blossom.
In the paper on Sunday, you talked about some issues you felt really needed to be worked on in the Siouxland community. You talked about healthcare. You talked about education and several other issues as well.
You know, and what you're referring to is our game changers for the NAACP. And you know, it's so important that, you know, when the NAACP, you know, leadership decided that they were going to really tackle the things that affect the African-American community. You know, health and education were definitely two of those six things. Now, here's the thing. We didn't know at the time that COVID-19 was going to be as prevalent and as big as it is. And so now even more, because we realized that the COVID-19, for whatever reason, we found that it was affecting the African-American community at a faster rate than other communities. Now, of course, we know that with COVID, that some of that has some underlying, you know, when you have some underlying health issues, well, that comes back to why we chose health, because one, you know, we have been a marginalized community and we haven't always gotten the best health care that, you know, we deserve. We haven't always had the best doctors, even in the community. When, you know, you think about community health and community centers and stuff like that, when you go to some of these communities, especially in the big cities and things like that, it was, you know, substandard things going on. And so it's important that we look at those things that affect our community. We know that diabetes and strokes and high blood pressure are huge, you know, factors. Now, you know, we realize that we have to take some personal responsibility as well. But, you know, when we are taking that responsibility, we should at least be given, you know, grade A health care and also, you know, ways to be affordable health care. That, you know, that falls right into that situation. And then you said education. Again, even as we speak, you know, Mary, Black children and children of color are really suffering from falling back. And we know that, again, you know, it's not the issue that's on top. It's the underlying things that may affect some of those things. But, you know, having technology, having economics that, you know, a family can afford to do what they need to do and feed their children. And I mean, think of how many latchkey kids, you know, we have in society. And this covers everybody. And I've said this before, when we fix those things, now, obviously, you know, we talk about Black Lives Matter and these things affect our community directly. But one thing we understand is that when we fix those things for us, and guess what? It fixes it for everybody. Because we realize that there are kids who are white, Black, whatever, that are struggling with some of those things that causes these issues to be prevalent in their lives, whether it be health or whether it be education. And so if we fix it for one, it fixes it for all. And that's really what we're trying to really accomplish and put out there to let people know, hey, you know, if you have one of your own that's oppressed and not you know, doing good that's weak and weary. Guess what? If you help that, it helps everybody because now everybody's thriving.
Since the death of George Floyd, there has been a lot of youth engagement all across the country and, you know, here in Siouxland. Do you think that youth engagement has really made a big difference?
Well, I think that, again, this is for the future. You know, we hear politicians talk about, excuse me, what are we going to leave our children? What are we leaving the future generation? And now, again, you hear many politicians talking about the deficit and those things. But, you know, directly related to what's going on right now, we understand that we have to have our youth engaged because one thing we realize is that in our community, in the Black community, that, you know, our history is very, very painful and very, and if they don't know that, we may find ourselves, you know, treading those waters again. And so one, we want to make sure that they know where they came from and what they're up against. And so, you know, and again, if we know that, then we know that they, and also that they have the energy. Now, over the last few weeks, yeah, we've had a lot of youth step up, and we are so thankful because they have the energy. And I think I've shared this to you with you before, but, you know, even in the pre-civil rights days when they were protesting, it was the youth. It was the youth at that time who stepped up because, you know, they had to endure some of those brutal attacks and pain with our ancestors and our older and elder generation. You know, they couldn't do it. They didn't have the stamina and the physical abilities to keep it going. So the youth have always been important and are very important to point to our lives and our current situation.
That was Ike Rayford, president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP. I talked to him in July about Juneteenth, as well as the many marches dedicated to the memory of George Floyd, who was killed by police in Minneapolis over the Labor Day weekend. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. COVID-19 has claimed the lives of more than 3,600 people in the state of Iowa since the beginning of the pandemic. About a third of them were residents of long-term care facilities, including a Siouxland man, Chris Menon. Chris had Down syndrome. He lived in Sanborn at Prairie View Nursing Home, which was the site of an outbreak of COVID-19. Chris died on August 6, 2020, at the age of 62, of respiratory failure and COVID-19 infection. His sister, Mary Sue Moore, lives in Milford, and she shares the details of his inspiring life. She wants people to be mindful of others at higher risk of serious complications of this devastating disease.
He was born in 1958. I was five, and he was born at a time before there was any public education mandated for special needs. And of course, that was at a time when doctors said, put him in an institution. He won't be able to learn. He won't be able to contribute. Au contraire, my parents were very faith-based in how they lived their lives, and they felt they needed to go out and find resources, and if there weren't any, to develop those. They were really pioneers in the late 50s for special needs individuals. Chris was, you know, just a huge part of our family from beginning to end. My mother, since he was number five, had raised babies before and taught them how to feed themselves and use the bathroom and all those things. And she was an amazing mother, but it was obvious when he was six that there were no actual resources for him locally to develop his outlook and his future. So he attended Martin Luther Home and School in Beatrice, Nebraska. It was at the very beginning of education for special needs. He did very well there. Of course, he has this huge personality. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at his DVD, but it's on the Mauer Johnson Funeral Home website, Lamar's. And it really shows all different sides of Chris from when he was a little guy, cutest little guy you'd ever imagine, you know, all the way through sports and all the different things that he participated in. Then at 18, that was when there were resources in Sheldon, which was only 30 miles from Lamar's. My parents enrolled him there. It was just a perfect match for him. And he worked in the workshop and had a wonderful social life. They traveled with the residents. He went on a cruise in the Caribbean with a group from the village. Village Northwest Unlimited in Sheldon is an amazing place, but they would go to baseball games in Kansas City and Vikings games up in Minneapolis, and he had an amazing, full, fun life. He was always a huge part of all of our families. Like I said, I'm next in line with Chris, and then we have three older siblings. And nieces and nephews adore Chris. We're so heartbroken when we lost him. He had lived at Village Northwest Unlimited for 43 years. Which is pretty amazing. He moved a year ago. We needed to move him out of the village because he no longer had the independence, the mobility, and he was developing some dementia, which is very, very common amongst Down syndrome individuals. And we moved him to Prairie View in Sanborn, just down the road. So he's just got lots of visitors from Sheldon and the staff who knew him and loved him. And it was a very good fit. It was a very good fit. It was also heartbreaking when they had to close down Prairie View because of COVID in February and could only see him through the window. That was a very difficult time for us and for him. I kind of called him the teacher's pet because everybody loved being around Chris. He got lots of extra attention from the staff and from the other residents. And so that was a very difficult time. And even with their very stringent protocols, unfortunately, there was a COVID outbreak. He would have been at the very top of the most vulnerable population to be impacted by COVID. He had COPD, and it was a condition that he was born with, extremely fragile respiratory system. He also was obese and just did not have the immune system or the strength to fight through it. So we lost him on the 6th of August. He was surrounded by the staff who loved him and talked with him. We FaceTimed those last couple of days with him. And it's just, you know, it's something that I do well most of the time, unless I talk about it, and then it makes me emotional. But he had a great life, and he was a symbol for all of us to make the most of your gifts, because so little was expected of him when he was born. And the gifts that he received and that he shared with everybody else were so abundant and so generous. And it was an amazing life. Certainly an argument for doing whatever we can to take care of our special needs population, because their potential is so great. We are going to have a celebration of life service for Chris next summer, when this COVID thing hopefully is all over and the whole family can come together. You probably saw in the obituary the big long list of family people. And as many of us as possible will gather next summer to celebrate. We'll do that at the camp up here, the Ingham Okoboji Lutheran Bible Camp, that loves and remembers him for all these years. There's actually a building there called Christopher House. It was brainchild of my parents, and it was the first special needs type of lodging at the camp. And so it was named, of course, after Chris. So people around the camp or even around the community, even if they didn't know Chris, they made the connection between Chris Menon and Christopher House. He will leave a lasting impression forever on all of us, anybody who knew him.
I read an obituary of your brother's without ever meeting him or knowing your family. And it just made such an impact. It talked about just the joy in his life, how he always smiled.
Yes.
And how he was an accomplished athlete with Special Olympics, and just the impact he made on you as a family and people who met him who were strangers.
Right, right. And he had an amazing memory. If he had ever met you, he would remember you. You know, until the past year or two, we said he knows you in his heart. Even if he doesn't seem to remember you, he knows you in his heart. And what's more important than that anyway, he was just, He was very high functioning. He was a chatterbox. He loved conversation. He and my husband and my brother-in-law used to tease each other, which was just hilarious. And they would just all belly laugh. And yes, the joy that he brought everybody was just, it was so contagious. And that he will be missed by so many people. And I'm hoping that some of your listeners will maybe read the obituary and just think of Chris as just an example of what a wonderful life and what a wonderful person he was, even though he was special needs.
And you were talking about his vulnerable health. I know with the COVID-19 right. pandemic, what do you want people to know about this disease?
Well, I would say that more than anything, that our vulnerable populations have to be protected. And I do feel that Chris and his environment was as protected as possible. But this is a very highly, highly infectious disease. It really just solidified the way that I feel about it already. And that being that we have these vulnerable populations, the downside of all that, of course, is their isolation and the lack of communication, having to see their loved ones through windows or on FaceTime. And that's also a heartbreak to all of this. I think unless you actually have a special person or an elderly person in a special care situation, you don't realize how isolated they are and how removed you are from being able to, you can't touch them, you can't hug them, and that's heartbreaking for everybody. So I think that's probably my biggest takeaway. It confirmed the way I already felt, that we have very vulnerable people, whether they're elderly or whether they're younger and have comorbidities. The other, they just, everything needs to be put in place to keep those people safe at this time until we get the vaccine and until we have better treatment options.
I just want to let you know that my thoughts are out to you and your family. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much, Sheila. I appreciate that. And it was a beautiful life. I guess that's the best way that I can describe Chris, is the joy and the love that he brought to so many people. He will be missed just every day. And we talk about him and we laugh and we're sad, but we laugh. And mom and dad have him now in heaven. And that's that also gives us great comfort. And all the kind words from everybody who knew him. We've just had such an outpouring of love, because everybody's missing him. Everybody who knew him is missing him. It's not just the family, the immediate family. Remind everybody about how unbelievable my folks were. And they set a standard of caring and loving and, advocating for your child that most people don't have to do, because most people have resources that they can go to, but my parents had nothing. And they were true pioneers, and really set the standard high for all of us. Don't give up on your child.
And that was Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer with the story of Chris Menon. Chris had Down syndrome. He lived at Prairie View Nursing Home in Sanborn, and that was the site of an outbreak of COVID-19. Chris died on August 6, 2020. He was 62 years old. He had respiratory failure and COVID-19 infection. And the Siouxland community also lost a committed and caring voice for immigrants and the Vietnamese community back on May 6th. Sheila Brummer takes a look at the life and legacy of a major community leader through the memories of two of her friends.
It's just because I like to do it. It's my pleasure.
That's Hong Cuc Thi Nguyen talking about her passion for helping people with a local television station after winning one of many honors for her selfless commitment to the community. Hong Cuc served as an advocate for immigrants, including people from her home country of Vietnam.
She was maybe like everybody's grandmother.
Erica DeLeon, the executive director of One Siouxland, first met Hong Cuc a dozen years ago in a previous position at the Mary Tralia Community House. Hong Cuc served on the board of directors and volunteered out of an office at the nonprofit organization.
She had come to the U.S. as a student on a student visa and then went back to Vietnam and was teaching. And she worked in the government in an administrative position where she had quite a bit of expertise and authority. They had sent her to Malaysia and she was supposed to be there for a month to teach math. And then Saigon fell and she never got to go home again. And she was actually stuck in Malaysia, I think 6 or 7 years before she was able to get to the United States.
Hung Cook arrived in Colorado, then relocated to Iowa City to finish her PhD in education.
And she goes, and then I got like a class or two away from being done and decided I didn't want to be in some high up administrative job. I had more fun when I got to actually work with people and make their lives better. So I decided just to be a social worker.
1981 brought her to Sioux City to a job with Lutheran Social Services as a refugee specialist. And DeLeon loved listening to her stories, historical, engaging.
She was just such a treasure to get to see and visit with. And we've just kind of maintained that friendship over the years.
DeLeon says for 3 decades, Hung Cook welcomed, acclimated, and connected newcomers with her position as a social worker. And her mission continued after retiring more than 20 years ago.
She was just the matriarch of the Vietnamese community and so well respected by anybody and everybody that interacted with her.
She will be greatly missed by the whole Sioux community.
And you can hear that respect in the voice of Peggy Law.
She changed a lot of the community perspective of everyone helping each other. So that's why I look up to her.
Law co-founded Asian Fest a few years back. She works at her family's Asian grocery store as she remembers her mentor, a woman she knew almost her whole life.
She is the most selfless person I've ever met. Whatever help you need in translation or anything that you need in the community, she'll guide you to that right direction. If she doesn't know the answer, she'll find an answer for you.
Law says she will miss Hung Cook's encouragement. Many consider Law someone who will emerge as the next community matriarch.
She always comes and check on us. Hey, how are you guys? Have a good business.
Law admits health problems did slow her friend down the past couple of years. A caretaker for Hung Cook says she tested positive for COVID-19 before passing away at the hospital on Wednesday, May 6th, almost a month after her 87th birthday. A long life lived for enlightening others on their journey in a new land.
So that I can continue to serve people.
For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
And now we remember a well-known Siouxland priest who passed away on Sunday, September 27th, due to complications of COVID-19. Father John Mikulski served many Catholic parishes in Siouxland during his half-century career. He was also known as the Carnival Priest and was appointed International Coordinator of Carnival Ministries by Pope John Paul II in 1993. His nephew, Brian Mikulski of Sioux City, talks to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about Father John and the impact he made during his life and why he will be missed by so many.
He did a lot of good for a lot of people in a lot of areas of both the country and the world. His vocation was to the church as an ordained Catholic priest, and even though he didn't have a nuclear family of his own, meaning a spouse and children, he had this great family of not only parishioners, but children of parishioners who he's met over the years, and then his extended family as the carnival priest. His ministry to the carnival industry around this country and around the world has been nothing short of outstanding to see. The people, the outpouring of people whose lives he touched just in the wake of his death has been absolutely amazing. He's baptized children of carnival workers. He's buried carnival workers, children of carnival workers. He's married carnival workers, and that became an extended family as well. So for somebody who by definition lives a life of solitude as a priest, he had more family and more friends than anybody who's lived the most gregarious of lifestyles.
He actually officially retired, but he was still pretty much working, wasn't he? With his ministry, with the carnival, and actually over the summer he was doing mass up at the Iowa Great Lakes too.
He was retired as a parish priest a few years back, and since then he had split his time between both living at Okoboji and in Florida. He lived in Ruskin, Florida, R-U-S-K-I-N, Florida, and he would serve several parishes in the Florida area and for simple demographics, mostly doing funerals, but he would also help with the weddings and baptisms, things like that. And I mean, these are mega parishes. They would make our parishes look like small country parishes down there. I mean, we're talking 3,500 families to a parish, and so they would have 6, 7, 8, 9 masses on a weekend, and so he would be down there to cover, and that was what he chose to do. And then he would also spend his time doing his carnival ministry, going to the not only the conventions but to various carnivals and state fairs around the country, and blessing the rides, blessing the games, blessing the people who work on the rides, the carnival employees themselves, and just maintaining that contact. And he also twice a year would lead his international tours, which is something he's been doing for almost 50 years, leading tours around the world to various places, some secular, some sacred. He would go to the Holy Land.
And I'm sure, of course, the pandemic greatly impacted him in so many ways. He couldn't do a tour that he wanted to do to Europe. He had another one planned next year for the Holy Land as well. So, and I also know with the pandemic, the carnival industry was hit hard too.
Yeah, there were a lot of carnivals and state fairs that were canceled. I don't think any of them happened this year. And so his life on the road was cut short, not just by his illness, but by the pandemic as well. And it affected how he lived too. He had cancer and was taking chemotherapy. And of course, that destroys your immune system. And somebody with a destroyed immune system is all the more susceptible to COVID-19. And so he was essentially a hermit for the last several months of his life, which had to have been a huge change for somebody like him who was always on the go. He was always out and about, and if I wanted to catch him, I'd have to catch him on his cell phone because he was rarely home. Having to see him live his last few months like that was heartbreaking because it was just a reminder that there's certain things that are beyond our control, and he had spent his entire life working and making a living for himself, doing what he wanted to do, and to essentially have that cut out from underneath him the last few months was really gut-wrenching to watch. I know it affected him personally and emotionally because he couldn't see the people that he wanted to see usually. He couldn't do the things that he normally enjoyed doing, which was the ministry in one form or another.
Your uncle did have terminal cancer, but he still was leading a good quality of life until COVID hit him personally. He caught COVID. Can you tell me how he caught the virus and kind of how the end of his life played out?
He was in the hospital for various complications from his cancer and tested negative for COVID while he was in the hospital. And upon his release from the hospital, it turned out he contracted COVID while he was in the hospital. And that was a huge shock to him because he took every social distancing precaution seriously, wearing the masks that we're supposed to wear, wearing gloves. I mean, he went above and beyond. He rarely went out of the house of where he was staying here in Sioux City, just because he knew that his immune system was compromised as a result of the chemotherapy, and yet he still managed to catch it somehow while he was at the hospital. And so that all of a sudden was a even further realization that of how powerful this disease is, this COVID-19, and that the social distancing measures, even among themselves, aren't enough to prevent that spread. And it affected him because he was all of a sudden back in the hospital with breathing problems and, you know, all the different symptoms that come with COVID. And that was eventually what was afflicting him when he passed away.
Father John Mikulskis, who died this summer from complications of COVID-19, celebrated his 50th anniversary of his ordination last summer with his family and friends. Thanks to Brian Mikulskis for sharing his uncle's story with Sheila, who first met Father John decades ago when he served as a priest in her hometown of Dow City. Father John was 76 years old. And finally today, a story about a Sioux City landmark. This past year was the end of a 128-year era for an alumni group at the Sioux City Old Central High School. The Castle on the Hill Association left the building at 13th and Nebraska. The group no longer resides there, where members once roamed the halls as high schoolers. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer shows us the legacy still living in those who attended Sioux City Central High.
When you were a senior, you were a cheerleader? Or?
Yes.
1960?
1960. Deborah Coons and Joan Dodds are two of the four Ferguson sisters who attended Central High back in the day.
Well, it's a football cheerleader. Yes, that's that infamous C jump that everybody tried
had to do to be a cheerleader. The C jump. Yes, that backwards C jump. Yes.
Did you guys find your pictures in the yearbooks too?
They search their memorabilia and memories as their mother LaVon looks on.
Well, I graduated in 1941. It's been quite a long time ago. But it's just sad to see that it's all closing, you know, the whole thing. But the building is still pretty impressive, I think.
So I was in the last graduating class, 1972.
Deborah Coons finds a yearbook from that last year of a school that first opened in 1892.
People you hadn't thought of in forever, because that's what, 40, almost 50 years? Well, 2 years will be 50 years. Oh my God. Oh my God. That I graduated from high school. I mean, you know, you don't feel that old, but then you're like, you know, well, I am 65.
I'm Frank Conkey, graduated here in 1963. I met my wife here. She was a junior and I was a senior.
Frank is a longtime volunteer of the Castle on the Hill Association. His wife, who passed away 4 years ago, even served as president.
It was called the Dump on the Hump, and I don't like those names, so I'm not going to tell you. We have quite a following as far as classmates, but as you can see, our classmates aren't getting any younger, and we're just going the other way rather than new blood coming in. We're losing classmates.
The alumni group took possession of the building in the 1970s before selling it to a developer more than 15 years ago for a dollar in exchange for a long-term lease that ran out at the end of the year. During that time, the group operated an office, gift shop.
Okay, you got 10?
Took care of the old gymnasium.
This is the dungeon.
And utilized a renovated auditorium.
Let me turn some lights on so we can really see it.
Illuminated by Frank, who after graduation spent time in the Navy before becoming an electrician.
It seats about 980 people here on the first floor. We've had it packed for different events in here, so it's really a nice venue for bands and so forth to come in.
One of his kids even got married here, and Frank, who volunteered his time and skills to the school's legacy, doesn't want to dwell on the inevitable as the owner wants them out.
It's too bad that we can't continue to use it, but we'll just have to see what the building management does as far as taking care of it. The last we knew that they were probably going to try to build apartments in here. And I realized money's money to them. It's not that I'm sure, you know, they're doing what they think is right, and, you know, we're upset with it. And, you know, but maybe it's our time to be leaving the castle.
As things change for the Castle on the Hill, history resurfaces for LaVon Ferguson, a former high schooler, now 96 years old.
And it was just a fun time then, you know. And I see that one of the sweatshirts here that has the school song, and one of my classmates wrote that.
And others shopping for their past pause for one final fight song with LaVon and her daughters.
Nights of the school.
In Sioux City, for Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Our castle, and long may it stand.
A representative for the owner of the Castle on the Hill says he wants to sell the apartment building to a new owner. The lease ended for the Castle on the Hill's association's lease earlier this year, but their eviction was delayed because evictions were suspended due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But over the summer, the Sioux City Journal reports, the group decided not to fight the eviction. Well, that's it for this edition of The Exchange, and this is the last edition of The Exchange for 2020. Thanks so much to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer, Steve Smith, Mark Munger, and Rick Turner. We hope you all have a great New Year's, and we will see you next week. I'm Mary Hartnett.